This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. With the holidays in mind, we're going to talk about some unconventional recipes. Unconventional in the sense that they challenge conventional wisdom and are designed to simplify preparation. Our first guests are Christopher Kimball and Bridget Lancaster. Kimball is the founder of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and Cook's Country Magazine, as well as two public TV shows, America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country from America's Test Kitchen. Lancaster is an on-screen test cook for both shows and is responsible for all recipe testing and development in Cook's Country. Cook's has a 2,500-square-foot kitchen just outside of Boston, where recipes are tested over and over and over again, varying the ingredients, techniques, and cooking times until the cooks and the tasters agree they've come up with the best version. 2,000 such recipes are collected in the new book, Cook's Illustrated Cookbook. Terry spoke with Kimball and Lancaster last week.
Christopher Kimball, Bridget Lancaster, welcome to Fresh Air. Christopher Kimball, let me start with you. Describe the mission of your test kitchen.
It's simple. It's three words, recipes that work. I think back in the 1970s, I realized after a series of very unsuccessful dinner parties, there was something wrong with recipes. It wasn't just me. And so I set out over the last 30 years or so to find a test kitchen methodology that would take recipes and turn them out in a way where people could actually make them at home with some fairly high degree of success.
Wait, the way you said there's something wrong with recipes and you wanted to fix them, it's a kind of broad statement to make. What was wrong with recipes?
Oh, I like broad statements. Look, here's nothing wrong. Like, here's the problem. The problem is cookbook authors, food writers, live in a fantasy world. It's a fantasy world where they can get all the ingredients. They're very good ingredients. They know what they're doing. When that recipe gets sent out into the world, you know, like your 18-year-old child, things happen to it. And we know, because we bring people into our kitchen and watch them cook our recipes and we send our recipes out by email, we know that what people do with those recipes bears little resemblance to what we do with them. For example, we sent a recipe out a couple of years ago to a gentleman for chicken breasts. He responded by saying it was the worst chicken recipe he'd ever made. And there was a comment area at the bottom of the form, and he wrote in, "I didn't have any chicken." And then he said, "I substituted shrimp." Well, 40 minutes of cooking shrimp in a skillet is simply not going to come out very well. And guess whose fault that was? Mine. So most of recipe writing has to do with what the person at home is going to do to your recipe. It's not whether you can make it in your test kitchen.
So something else you, I think, neglected to mention about a lot of cookbooks is that they assume you have a lot of time. And you're often doctoring recipes so that you don't need to take so much time. And one of the things that you do is try to simplify things so that you don't have to get like the finest ingredients in the world. You don't have to have a whole lot of time. And there's certain shortcuts that you do. So I want to kind of get a few examples from you of things that you've tried that have worked that you think make it easier to cook. So with the holidays coming, just tell us one simple thing that you learned about turkeys. Bridget, you want to take that one?
Sure. Turkeys. Well, there's a lot that can go wrong with those big old birds. And the fact that we only practice cooking it usually once a year. That's a huge problem with turkey. So especially for turkey, the one thing that you want to do is make sure that it's perfect when it comes out. So there's a couple things that you can do. You can brine it, which is something that we talk about soaking turkey or a lot of other different kinds of proteins in a salt and water solution. And that makes especially the white meat stay really nice and juicy so that even if it tends to overcook a little bit, it's still going to come out really nice. The other thing that we do is salt it. Just, you know, basically rub some salt underneath the skin. It has a similar property to brining. But one of the things that I love that I've been doing in the past few years is basically dissecting a turkey and then roasting it in parts. It's the most genius concept, I think, that we've come across. You roast a turkey breast, you roast the parts, they all go on the same sheet pan, they go in the oven, it's a slow roast. But
they go in at the same time?
They go in the same time right onto a sheet pan. and it comes out. The turkey breast is perfect. The legs, the thighs, there's hardly any flipping or dancing with the turkey that's necessary. It's the most hands-off recipe that you could really come across.
Okay,
one of my favorites.
So one question, how do you dissect the turkey part?
Well, you don't even have to do that yourself. You can buy a bone-in turkey breast, and then you can buy the turkey parts yourself. Or
oh, that sounds so cheating. Is that okay?
Yeah, it's right? Totally okay. It's well, legit. See, that's what we don't tell you. You can buy all those parts, and you don't have to do all the work yourself. But you know, I'm kind of a mad knife wheeler in the kitchen, so I like hacking that thing up and getting my aggressions out on it. Plus, you get the back, and you get to use that for stock and stuff like that.
So, in talking about shortcuts, one of the things, Bridget, that you demonstrated on the TV show is a minestrone soup, where all of the ingredients you get from the supermarket, nothing uh-huh. fancy, and you had a real, like, shocking shortcut to making the broth. And the shocking shortcut included buying V8.
That's right. That's a good way to get your vegetables.
Yeah. So I want you to describe this recipe and how you came up with it.
It was very interesting. I mean, when you think about what goes into minestrone, it's kitchen sink soup. So there's a whole bunch of different muddled flavors that go in there. But one of the flavors that have to go in there, in our opinion, was tomato. And we were just having a lot of trouble with finding tomato products that didn't make it taste like a bad pasta sauce. You know, and then we also talked about making kind of a broth, but that's what we wanted, something nice and light. And somebody just mentioned, well, why don't we just try V8, like the commercial says. And V8 was perfect. I mean, it gave just the right body to the minestrone, right amount of seasoning. It's kind of a, you know, an 8-for-1 instead of a 2-for-1 ingredient because it has all those different flavors in it all in one shot.
But then you doctored it.
Oh, yeah, we doctored it. We had pancetta in that recipe, I think.
I think there's a little chicken broth in there.
That's right.
Well, there has to be meat.
Oh, yeah. It has to be meat.
Yeah.
I mean, any recipe of mine, even vegetarian, has to have meat.
Well, yeah. I think the joke around the test kitchen is our next book will be Vegetarian Cooking with Bacon.
That's my huge name, Bacon.
So speaking of doctoring, you also have a quick beef and vegetable soup using doctored store-bought beef broth. So how do you shop for the right beef broth to doctor? Just a broth that you like?
Well, we do tests. We do a lot of tastings of beef broth. And that is always an interesting day, trying to get enough people to show up for beef broth tasting. Because basically what we do is we heat up the broth and people sip it out of cups. But that's how we come up with the best brand. Now, of course, beef broth has come a long way, but it's still a far cry from anything that you can make homemade. But, you know, when you compare having to spend hours and hours and hours making your own really great homemade beef broth versus opening up a can, it's a lot easier to doctor it.
Well, we did find with chicken and beef broth that if you look on the back of the can at the ingredient list, sometimes you never see chicken or beef mentioned at all. And it's certainly not in the first 3 or 4 ingredients.
Right.
So it's usually better living through chemicals. It's some...
Or salt.
Or salt. And I think the last time we rated them, believe it or not, Rachel Ray's beef stock won. But beef stock in general isn't very good. I mean, chicken stock's better.
Yeah, it is better.
But canned beef stock is usually not very good. In fact, we had our own recipe where the best recipe was 6 pounds, some huge amount of beef.
Massive. And you have to use meat more than bones
meat.
To make it.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, in the old days, they made it out of bones because they were cheap and they were recycling ingredients. And that's why they cooked it all day. But making beef out of bones is difficult because if you use meat, it's got more flavor. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's also more expensive.
So say you're making a beef vegetable soup and you're avoiding spending all day, you know, like simmering the soup and having the beef, you know, the beef or the beef bone in it. So what else are you doing? How are you doctoring this store-bought canned beef broth?
Well, you're definitely going to have to use beef in there. You're going to have to brown cuts of beef to use in the soup. But there's also something called glutamates, and that's what we're looking for in a beef vegetable soup. Those are flavor compounds that make things taste meaty. So things like tomato paste, which I believe goes into that soup. There's also lots of mushrooms that go into that soup. Mushrooms have that really meaty flavor. Soy sauce is another one that has a lot of the glutamates in it. And that's one of those secret ingredients that we'll often reach for, soy sauce, tomato paste, mushrooms, to boost foods that maybe don't have that oomph, that substance, that meatiness on their own.
So when you're throwing in the mushrooms, do you sauté them first?
Definitely. Definitely. You would want to cut them up as small as possible so that you have a lot of little release cuts, a lot of places for all that flavor to come out. And then you always want to sauté them in butter, or even better, in pancetta or bacon if you have it.
Okay. There goes the bacon.
There goes the bacon again. Yeah.
So since it's winter, let's get to another soup. A creamy pea soup recipe that you have uses frozen peas.
That's right.
So why are frozen peas tastier than fresh peas?
That's another thing that we say. They're actually picked right when they're at their most fresh point. If you go to the supermarket or farmer's market and buy fresh peas, there's literally like a three-day period where fresh peas taste great. And then you've got to buy them by the bushel. So, or you can go and you can buy – somebody else has done all the work for you. So it's kind of the same thing. They actually pick them right when they are at their best, and they flash freeze them. And they're great. I mean, especially if you're using them as an ingredient in something such as a stew, a soup, something. The key is to really add them almost like an herb right at the end and let them sit in either the soup or if you're making a risotto for just 5 minutes to warm them up, because they're basically tender right out of the bag.
I think tomato is another example where a supermarket tomato is always inedible, and we always call for canned tomatoes. Yep. Even making tomato soup, they're vastly better. So there are times when canned or frozen is better than the fresh ingredient, at least in a supermarket.
So let's look at another main course. You have a recipe for chicken in a pot. What was the problem you were trying to solve?
Well, actually, this is a recipe you get if you go to any bistro in Paris, and they come out with usually a metal cocotte or small oval pan.
It's like a casserole.
Yeah, like a casserole dish with a top. And they take the top off at the table, and what you get inside is the most flavorful chicken in the world that's been really cooked in its own juice, as it were. The skin is marginal, but the flavor is great. And that was what we started with. And so the whole notion is to cook a chicken in a Dutch oven, you know, a covered casserole, with just a few vegetables, and really add almost no additional liquid to it. And its own juices come out, and it almost braises the bird. You get a lot of flavor. And we ended up starting off browning, breast side down, browning it for a few minutes first in the pot just to develop some browning and also some flavor in the bottom of the pot. But it's all about retaining the flavor of the chicken and getting a very moist bird. And also, with a nice cast iron pot, you can cook it nice and evenly at fairly low temperature. Mm-hmm. It takes over an hour. And so it's nice and gentle. The breast meat gets cooked properly. The dark meat gets cooked properly. And you have a lot of flavor. And it takes, what, 3 or 4 minutes? 5 minutes of preparation?
If that.
Yeah, a few garlic cloves, a little
I think there's
herb.
A celery in there.
Yeah. Yep. And you're done. And that's it. It takes an hour, hour and 10 minutes to cook. And it's the world's simplest chicken recipe, but has a lot of flavor.
And the pan juices that come out of the chicken are amazing. I mean, it's almost worth just throwing away the chicken, just drinking the pan juices.
So let's get to a side dish. You have a recipe for French fries. What's the problem you were trying to solve?
French fries. French fries, one of the things is to make great French fries, you have to twice fry them. And what I mean by that is after you've cut the potatoes into planks or into strips, you have to start them in oil, basically to get most of the cooking done, but not really the browning. And then you have to let them sit out of the oil. And then later on, you fry them again. And that's to really build up the crust on the French fries, make it nice and fluffy in the center and really, really crusty on the outside. We wanted to rethink that. This is another one of those classic dishes. There's one way to cook French fries. And we wanted to go back and test this. And this is the cold oil, starting potatoes in cold oil, which everything about that sounds wrong to me. You know, we've been told if the oil temperature isn't hot enough, the potatoes are actually going to soak up all that oil, and you're going to end up with greasy French fries. But this is amazing. As the potatoes come up to temperature, the oil comes up to temperature, the potatoes come up to temperature, they actually will not soak up the oil until they get to a certain point. And once you've heated up the French fries, they're pretty darn amazing. They start to cook slowly. They're nice and tender on the outside, and then they build up a crust on their own. It completely changed the way in the test kitchen that we think about cooking French fries.
Well, we actually tested them after we had fried them, and they had a third less fat, saturated fat.
That's
from
right.
The oil. It was actually less oil in the fry, and we did a little science experiment with it, and we found there were two things going on. One is they can't absorb oil until they lose moisture. So the oil is replacing the water that was in the potato. So you put potatoes in a cold oil, there's no transfer of oil to potato. The other thing is that a lot of the oil absorption happens in the cooling down period. So a typical French fries fry twice. When it cools down the first time, oil is getting sucked in. Into it. And then the second time. With our method, there's only one cooling down period at the end, and that means less oil. So you get substantially less oil. And by the way, this idea came from Joel Robuchon, the French chef. He actually, I think, was the one who pioneered the cold oil, so we need to give him credit. But less fat, and it's much easier. It takes, 25 minutes from start to finish, and you don't have to keep moving fries in and out of hot oil. It's also not very messy.
Okay, time for dessert. You have what you describe as a foolproof pie crust that uses vodka. So what's the problem you were trying to solve by adding vodka?
Well, a couple of years ago, I went down to the test kitchen and said, I've been making pie crusts for 40 years, and they never come out the same way twice. And I said, look, can't we come up with a recipe that actually works consistently? The problem with pie crust is this. You need a fairly wet dough to make it easy to roll out. And most recipes say add only enough water until the dough holds together. Well, most people don't add enough liquid. The dough is crumbly and dry. You've probably had this problem with Thanksgiving. And so when you roll it out, it falls apart. Well, we've all had that problem. If you add too much liquid, then when you bake it, there is more gluten formation. That is, when water comes in contact with flour, gluten, which is what you develop when you make bread, starts to be formed, and you get a tougher crust. So on one hand, you want liquid to roll out dough. On the other hand, you want a dry as possible dough to get a tender dough. When you substitute half the water you use in the recipe for vodka, you end up using more total liquid. I think we used about 8 tablespoons.
Something like that, right?
Instead of 6. So you have more liquid. It makes it easy to roll out. When you bake it, half of that vodka, which is 1/4 of the total liquid, is alcohol. And almost all of that dissipates in the heat of the oven. So you end up with a very dry, very tender, very flaky dough, but you can also roll it out.
All right, because there's no gluten development in the vodka itself.
And is vodka the best alcohol to use because it doesn't have as strong a taste as, like, you wouldn't use bourbon, for instance?
No. Well, I use bourbon for everything, but I would probably use bourbon. But yes, it's flavorless. And as Bridget said, alcohol, when in contact with the protein and flour, does not form gluten. So gluten formation is a really big problem in pastry because you don't want, in most recipes.
You want some.
You want a little because you need to have it hold together.
Right.
But a really tough pie crust, we've all had them, is due in part to too much gluten being formed.
And this pie dough is super forgiving, too. I mean, you can actually use tons of flour on the board while you're rolling it out. And we found that a lot of people have a fear of rolling out pie dough. It's one of the things that they despise the most when it comes to the holidays is that the actual action of making pie dough, they're terrified of it.
Yeah, we should talk about fear for just a second. You know, so often you pick up a cookbook or watch a TV show and someone says, with only 5 ingredients in 20 minutes, you can turn out this great meal. And everyone knows that's actually not true. So our job, and if you watch the show, we start with bad food. We start with a disaster. You know, we say, look, this is a horrible lasagna. Maybe we can do better. So by starting with a worst-case scenario, I think it puts people at their ease, and they come away and say, oh, well, if he can do it, you know, or, you know, if the test kitchen showed me bad food, it makes people comfortable. Because I think the learning process is more about what goes wrong than what goes right.
All right. Entertain us with one of the biggest mistakes you've ever made in the test kitchen. Make us feel superior.
Well, a number of times you put a hot Pyrex casserole dish on a wet countertop.
Mm.
Have you ever? That actually happened to one of our folks on TV recently.
Oh, that's a recipe for cooked countertop, isn't it?
No, it's a recipe for a terrorist explosive.
really?
It goes into about 1,000 pieces. It explodes.
That's right.
All over. We've had this happen 2 or 3 times.
Actually, it sounds dangerous. I shouldn't be laughing.
Well, I happen to have been in the test kitchen all 3 times this has happened, which may make me look suspect. But, one of the things we did, we were working on a gumbo years ago, and we were trying to figure out the easiest way to make a roux. And so we actually found in a couple of cookbooks a microwave roux where you...
Oh, I remember this. Yeah.
You mix the flour and oil in a specifically a Pyrex measuring cup, and you microwave it. Well, at that particular time, the countertops, I think, were soapstone. And soapstone contains, usually has a little bit of moisture from washing dishes. Well, we took that. The roux looked beautiful coming out of the microwave, looked beautiful. Took that out. It was really hot. Put it on the countertop. And we were kind of staring at it, looking at the roux, going, I wonder if this is going to be brilliant if this works. Well, we started to hear this tick, tick. As the glass was starting to contract very quickly. And then it was like a scene from Lethal Weapon. This bomb went off. It was shards of glass everywhere. Test cooks were diving across the counter to get away from it. And it was hot roux everywhere. Needless to say, we scratched the idea of microwave roux.
So we're almost out of time, but I'm just curious. Do you cook Christmas dinner?
Absolutely. Yeah,
definitely.
What are you making?
Well, I always like to make a braise, and I make it the day before so that on Christmas I get to enjoy myself. So I'm probably going to make a beef burgundy this year.
I do boiled beef. I'm a huge fan of the old notion of boiling a nice piece of veal or beef for a few hours until tender. I take it out, and then I have a great broth. Take vegetables for 15 or 20 minutes, cook them in the broth, and serve a little sauce or something on the side. And it's a boiled beef dinner. It's very, very traditional, and that's what I always serve on Christmas.
All right. Well, happy holidays.
Same to you.
And to you.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Christopher Kimball and Bridget Lancaster speaking with Terry Gross. Kimball is the founder of Cooks Illustrated magazine, and Lancaster is an on-screen test chef for Cooks' 2 public TV shows. 2,000 recipes are collected in the new Cooks Illustrated cookbook. You can find some of Cook's recipes on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, has a review of the new Black Keys album, El Camino. The band actually is 2 guys, guitarist Dan Auerbach and drummer Patrick Carney. Ken says while the new album retains the band's roots in R&B, it's also reaching out to a wider audience with its pop and rock touches. Well, I'm so above you, and it's plain to see, but I came to love you in a way. So you hold my heart out, and I don't mind bleeding. Any old time to keep me waiting, waiting, waiting. Oh.
Careening into your ears like the theme to a bank heist flick. That's Lonely Boy, the first single from El Camino. Except the lyric tucked inside the roaring, curve-hugging melody isn't about anything so action-packed as robbing a bank or making a getaway. Instead, Dan Auerbach sings about stasis. Quote, I got a love that keeps me waiting. And being the sensible rocker that he is, Auerbach is willing to wait out his love because he knows in his heart that she's worth it. And therein lies the not-so-dirty secret about the Black Keys. They come on tough, but they're sensitive souls.
Ready, ready, ready.
On that song, Dead and Gone, Auerbach delivers a series of assertions, each of which, at first, seems to offer the sentiments of the singer, only to be revealed as the words of the lover who's rejecting him. "Don't call me, I'll call you," he says, then adds, "is what you say." Then comes the kicker rhyme, "I'll obey." One thing the Keys learned from the blues is that supplication can be a beautiful thing.
Little black submarines operator, please put me back on the line. Told my girl I'd be back, operator, please. This is wrecking my mind. Oh, can it be? Voices calling me, they get lost and out of time. I should have seen it glow, but everybody knows that a broken heart is blind. That a broken heart is blind.
Little Black Submarine suggests the stylistic tugs and pulls the Black Keys are feeling these days. It begins with the pretty acoustic melody that I just played. There's a description of a guy who's been separated from the woman he loves until, about 2 minutes in, the song takes on a new, louder urgency. The increasing desperation to avoid the broken heart he's singing about is mirrored by a shift in the music, which becomes louder, more vehement, more hard rock in music terms, and in emotional terms, more desperate.
Treasure maps, falling trees, operator, please call me back when it's time. Stolen friends and disease, operator, please pass me back to my mind.
El Camino was co-produced by the Black Keys and Brian Burton, who produces and performs under the name Danger Mouse. Together, they do a good job of turning the Black Keys into a number of things, including an up-to-date version of ZZ Top, heavy on relentless blues guitar riffs, placed within the catchy choruses of a pop song. You can almost hear the Black Keys' beards growing as they boogie through the ZZ Top-ish tune, Run Right Back.
Before she hits the ground.
The Black Keys are both in their early 30s. Moving from their native Akron, Ohio to Nashville to make their seventh studio album, they've achieved a sound that's frequently brighter, more open and eager, less closed in or doomstruck. They may sing about being perpetually disappointed in either their own behavior or that of the objects of their affection, but the guitars and drums tell a different story. El Camino turns out to really be their revved-up getaway car after all. They've moved from state to state, on the run to reinvent themselves. It sounds as though they've gotten away with their sly plan.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the new Black Keys album, El Camino. The new movie J. Edgar stars Leonardo DiCaprio as J. Edgar Hoover, the first director of the FBI, who held that position for 48 years. The film was directed by Clint Eastwood and written by our next guest, Dustin Lance Black. Black also wrote for the HBO series Big Love and won an Oscar for his screenplay for the movie Milk about the assassinated gay activist and San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk. Terry spoke with Black last week. J. Edgar portrays Hoover as a man who transformed law enforcement, but became so paranoid about communism that he spied on anti-war and civil rights activists, including Martin Luther King Jr. While collecting secrets about others and using those secrets against them, Hoover kept his own secret. His relationship with Clyde Tolson, whom Hoover promoted to the position of the Bureau's assistant director. That relationship is at the heart of the movie. Leonardo DiCaprio plays Hoover, Armie Hammer plays Tolson. Here's DiCaprio from the film's opening.
Communism is not a political party. It is a disease. It corrupts the soul, turning even the gentlest of men into vicious, evil tyrants. What we are seeing is a pervasive contempt for law and order. Crime rates are soaring. There's widespread open defiance of authority. And mark my words, if this goes unchecked, it will once again plunge our nation into the depths of anarchy.
Dustin Lance Black, welcome to Fresh Air. Welcome back. Before we talk about writing the screenplay for J. Edgar, would you just mind giving us a little bit of your assessment of Hoover before we get into what his sexual orientation was and what we know about that? But just
sure.
In terms of like the FBI and our country, what are a couple of things you really give him credit for and a couple of things you think were really harmful to America?
Well, I really, in my research, I found the story of J. Edgar Hoover is a story of two men, in a way. If you look at his youth, he was so brilliant and so promising, and I give him credit for a lot of things. He helped organize the Library of Congress at a very young age. He had a belief in science that a lot of people did not share, and believed that science could help solve crimes in a way that hadn't been used before, that this sort of evidence, like fingerprinting, some of the forensic science, could help solve crimes that before you could not solve because all people really believed in was firsthand accounts of a crime. And also probably the biggest thing he did was to understand that in this country we needed federal laws, that we'd come to a time where we could no longer put up with criminals robbing a bank in Texas and crossing into Oklahoma and being able to mock the police right across the border. And he knew that needed to end because it had created this air of lawlessness. Now, he did all these things before 1940. And I think if he had retired, he would be seen as a great hero in this country. But he didn't. And he became a dinosaur. And he started using the tools, the methods that he learned in his youth to do great harm to this country and to rob people of their civil liberties and to rob people of their right to privacy. And those are some of the stories we hear about him wiretapping people in order to maintain his own power in Washington, D.C., intimidating people with their secrets, even though he had so many secrets of his own. And in the end, I think he was really a man who should have retired much earlier, and I think his legacy would have been set.
But your film wouldn't have been nearly as interesting.
No, it wouldn't.
So what led you to do a film about Hoover? Was that your idea, or were you asked to write a screenplay?
I had been interested in Hoover for some time. It was actually my little brother, I think in 2007, gave me a Christmas present, a book called Young Hoover. And you read this book, it really only goes through the time up until Hoover starts creating the FBI. And it was not the man I knew. The man that I grew up with, the J. Edgar Hoover I grew up with, was this monster. And that was not the person portrayed in this book. And I found it really interesting. And I started to do a little bit more reading. And really, I found that all of these biographies out there about J. Edgar Hoover contradict each other. And certainly none of them seemed to get into what I was really interested in, which was why. Why did this man become what he became? And how is it that we have this man who shaped this country in the 20th century, arguably the most powerful man in this country in the 20th century, and we might know what he did, but we have no clue why?
Well, the emotional story you tell is of, you know, a man who is very sexually repressed and is probably in love with the person who he makes his number two, the associate director of the FBI, Clyde Tolson, but can't physically right. express that love because he is so repressed and because of the way his mother brought him up. His mother would probably rather see him dead than gay. Your film kind of says, is this maybe why he was so paranoid about other people and about whether they were communists? And is this maybe why he spied on people, including spying on their sexual liaisons? So do you think right. that sexual repression might have been behind what made him, as you describe, a monster?
I do. I mean, I think that one of the symptoms is that he understood the power of secrets And I think he used that against many people who he knew also had secrets in their personal life. For me, what became clear was this was a young man who from a very early age was never given the right to love. If you read his mother's writings, it was very clear that she did not feel this was something he could do. Some of the quotes in the film about, I'd rather have a dead son than a daffodil for a son, are slightly changed from her own writings, where she said she'd rather have a dead son than a lily for a son. And
where did she say that? I didn't know that there were writings that she left behind.
Yeah, there's not a ton, but she and her son did keep journals, thankfully, and some of that is public. And so you can read some of the things she wrote. She was a very ambitious person in Washington, D.C., at a time when you needed a man to take you to the parties. And her husband was quite ill, mentally ill. And I think she saw it as a great gift that she had a son who was not particularly interested in women. And she could help him along in his career and encourage that and say, you know, probably the most important thing is your career. And it is the admiration of your fellow man in Washington, D.C. And I think that's what he was left with. And I think that's actually where the darkness comes from, because if that's all you have is political admiration and public admiration, that is fleeting. And when it starts to fade, as it always does, as it does with any political figure, you'll do anything to hold on to it. And I think you'll lose your moral compass.
So you were in the position of writing a movie about the most secretive part of Hoover's life. I mean, that's not all the movie's about, but that's the kind of central part of it. That's like the core of the film. I mean, no matter how much research you did, and I know you did a lot, that's the part of his life that he kept secret. So how do you find out, like, did he really love his associate director of the FBI, Clyde Tolson? Did they really have an intimate relationship? Did they ever consummate that relationship? How do you get insights into that?
Well, I started by reading everything I could on the man. And for me, it's important to try and get firsthand sources. And thankfully, there are still a lot of FBI guys who are around that knew him. And a lot of them have settled down here in Simi Valley in Southern California. And a lot of them will talk in a way about J. Edgar Hoover that I don't think they would have 20 years ago. I don't think that even folks from that generation feel that being gay means you can't be an American hero. And that's a huge shift. But even some of his closest associates will say, you know, we don't know. And it's possible. And when you start to look at the facts surrounding Mr. Hoover and Mr. Tolson, they beg a lot of questions. These men showed up to work together every day in the same car and went home together in the same car. They went to lunches together every day and dinner every night, all of their vacations together, shared hotel rooms. These things are easily found.
Shared hotel
and easily
suites.
Provable.
So they could theoretically each have had their own room.
Yes. Well, sometimes in Miami, they didn't share hotel suites.
Oh, okay.
That wasn't sort of a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. When they went on vacations together. And this is a time before carpooling was popular, and they certainly could have afforded their own rooms. And and some of the evidence that gets more personal are things like the collection of photographs that J. Edgar Hoover has that he took of Clyde Tolson sleeping. You as you get closer to them, you find that there's a very, very personal relationship there. Now, that's not proof in any way. But as you start to learn about the rules of the time, which was the next layer of research for me, and I went to Washington, D.C., and I talked with many men who are now in their 80s and 90s who spent their time working for the government in a time before you could come out, pre-sexual revolution, pre-Stonewall. They described the rules to me, and they described the behavior to me. And all of a sudden, J. Edgar Hoover and Clyde Tolson snapped into very sharp focus.
Give me an example of some of the rules that they were telling you that helped bring Hoover and Tolson's relationship into focus.
Well, a lot of it was very heartbreaking to me. And I thought I knew the history of gay people, and some of it I didn't know. And a lot of it was what you couldn't say and what couldn't be discussed. Just the danger of ever acknowledging that you had these feelings. And certainly one of the things that I found really heartbreaking, and that it really informed, I think, the way I portray their relationship in this film, is that oftentimes, if the relationship was consummated, that was the signal for the end of the relationship. It was just too dangerous. And so a lot of these relationships weren't consummated. And if they were, it was never discussed. And you would absolutely need to take on, you know, a wife of some sort if you wanted to continue to rise in your position in the federal government.
Well, let me play a scene from J. Edgar. And I think this will give us a good sense of how you've handled their relationship. This is a scene at lunch at a very nice restaurant. And Hoover and Tolson are already very close and already working together. This is the scene in which Hoover offers Tolson the job as his number two, the associate director of the FBI.
Clyde, I've been meaning to ask you something.
Feel free.
I need someone who understands what's at stake here. You understand? Someone who I can trust. An associate director of the Bureau. Now, I know you've only been in your current position for, what, 12 months now?
Oh, almost 18 now, sir.
You're missing my point, Clyde. I want you to be my number two man.
I'm not much for the spotlight, Edgar.
I need you, Clyde. You understand? I need you.
On one condition. Good day or bad, whether we agree or disagree, we never miss a lunch or a dinner together.
Well, I would have it no other way.
Okay, so in that scene, Clyde Tolson accepts the position under the condition that they always have lunch and dinner together, even if they're angry with each other. Is that how right. You imagined it, or is there an evidence that it actually happened that way when Hoover offered the job to Tolson?
Well, it's all rooted in fact and discovery. They did have these lunches together from then on every single day. And certainly the fact that Clyde had only been there for 18 months before he got the number two position, he was not qualified for the position. These two had a very personal connection, and they would admit as much. There were effusive letters that went back and forth between them. And so at a certain point, for me, I like to ground everything I can in some sort of reality, especially on this movie where there's so much myth out there about him and such a lack of clarity about the truth. But then at a certain point, when it's two men alone who are both gone and you can't get a firsthand account, you have to fill in the blanks. And that's why I try and spend as much time as possible, in this case about a year and a half, researching them, getting to know them, walking in their footsteps, so that I understanding how they talk and the sort of words they would use, and so that it's as close to accurate as possible. That is my goal when I'm writing these things.
So the movie is written from J. Edgar Hoover's point of view. The movie's seen through his eyes. So you had to figure out how to write in his voice.
Yes.
Did you find tapes of Hoover speaking, not just making speeches, but speaking extemporaneously?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot there. And it was wonderful to do that research and to dive into his very strange accent, which isn't one I think you would find today. It was an amalgam of a lot of different sort of East Coast accents. And he invented his own words, and he loved animal metaphors. He liked slippery, slimy, snaky sort of word choices to describe criminals. So it was fun in a way to mine that from both his public speeches, which were slightly different than, say, his phone conversations. And thankfully, we have some of those taped because the presidents, you know, from Nixon to Johnson, would tape those conversations. I dug up as much as I could, and when I felt comfortable stepping into his voice, did so and included them.
What was it like working with Clint Eastwood? Did he want to talk with you about the script and your motivation for writing certain scenes? Did he ask you for insights and ask you about subtext and things like that? Or did he just, like, take the screenplay from you, wave goodbye, and direct it?
No, it was thankfully, our introduction was over the phone. Once he had agreed to do it, we had one meeting in person, because then I wasn't just staring at Clint Eastwood. That would have been rather intimidating, at least at first. And so it was over the phone, and he would call, and we would spend quite some time going through the script. He wanted to know where everything came from. He wanted to read all of the books I'd read. He wanted to hear the interviews I'd done. And he wanted to make sure that things were grounded in fact. And I really respected that.
I'm wondering if he asked you about this. part of the experience that you could write from in writing the story of J. Edgar Hoover is knowing what it's like to be closeted, because you grew up in a Mormon family and didn't want to admit to yourself that you were gay for a while, let alone to anybody else. I mean, you were afraid you were going to go to hell.
Sure.
So, I mean, you know what it's like to have this secret that scares you, and that you know would scare other people even more, and that you could lose everything if they found out. So did Eastwood ever want to know from you, what is it like to be in the closet and to be afraid of your own feelings?
You know, Clint never asked. And we had long conversations. We spoke for hours and hours and hours on end over the phone and then in person and then on set. I was there each day. And he had every opportunity to, and he just didn't need to. And I think Clint knows plenty of gay men who of his generation, and I think he's heard the stories now. He knows what that was. And it was one of the great benefits of doing this with Clint is I didn't have to describe everything. He lived the history. He got the post-toasties box with the FBI badge in it when he was a kid. So I didn't have to describe that. For me, the challenge was not projecting my own feelings onto it. And I knew that would be a challenge. I knew I did not want to project my pain of having been closeted onto J. Edgar Hoover and Clyde Tolson. And so I had to constantly ask myself, am I doing that? And make sure that I wasn't. At the same time, as it became clear and clear to me who these men were, you know, I do draw on my own personal experience, and I do probably understand it on a level that many wouldn't, especially of my generation, because I grew up in an atmosphere in the Mormon church, in the military, where I also had to stay closeted for my own survival.
Well, Dustin Lance Black, it's really been great to talk with you again. Congratulations on the film, and thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dustin Lance Black speaking with Terry Gross. Black wrote the screenplay for the new movie, J. Edgar. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.